Hi, this is Ken Bruce from BBC Radio 2. You're listening to Radio J-Com in Leeds.
Welcome to Radio J-Com 1386 Medium Wave, also to be found at radiojcom.com. You're listening to me, Susie Gordon, the Community Development Executive, on a show called It's All About You, to find out all about our community organisations. And we're really fortunate for today's show to be all about the Holocaust Survivors Friendship Association, also known as HSFA, which aims to preserve the memory, testimony and records of the Holocaust survivors who are based in Yorkshire for research, teaching and learning. And to tell us more is our lovely guest, Lillian Black, the chair of the association, whose father, Eugene Black, is a Holocaust survivor. And welcome to our show.
Thank you, Susie. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us. We're really interested to find out more about this association. Just to start with, why does it exist? Why was it set up?
It was established originally in 1995 by the survivors themselves for mainly friendship and association. So that was the origin of the HSFA.
They just to support each other?
Well, it was to support each other and to, I suppose, share experiences, although not necessarily talking about the experiences, to be in the community with each other. Because there is a silence about the Holocaust, which is not communicated through words. It's a sense and a feeling. And they came together and they found friendship, support. And it was only later that they actually realised, as they began to talk about the Holocaust, that they had a mission, which was about communicating the lessons from their own sad experience. And that's how the education activity actually started, going all the way back to 1995.
And they realising how important it is to spread the word and
yes.
to share their...
Yes.
So that must be very hard for them.
Well, I think we call it the long silence, and I think many Holocaust families recognise that, me included, as a daughter of a survivor, that it was actually many years before my father could actually talk about his experiences.
And how did you get it out? Like, how did that even start? From not talking about it to actually having that conversation? I mean, there must be families out there whose relatives are Holocaust survivors and never spoken about it. How did you start that going? How did you start the dialogue?
I think, well, I suppose the dialogue really started, truly started, when my father gave his personal testimony to the Shoah Foundation, which, of course, was Spielberg, who donated all the profits from Schindler's List to recording 58,000 personal testimonies. And one day someone approached my father and said, would he give his testimony? And that was organised, but it was the first time that the family had actually heard the complete story without any sort of pause at all. Because, of course, in childhood, we just found things out really, well, mainly by asking my mother. I never felt I could ask my father because it was so horrible and it was so painful that I didn't want to hurt my father by
putting
giving
questions.
Yeah, I just, as a child, couldn't do that. So he really did a great service by donating the profits of Schindler's List to this massive project, which, of course, now we can access the resources there at the Shoah Foundation.
So, really, you covered the point of why it was set up particularly for Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Why is it so important to you? Why you're a chair of the association, you're obviously heavily involved in it.
Yeah.
It must take up a lot of your spare time, you do it voluntarily.
Does. Yeah.
How come you're so involved?
I suppose, really, it's because I'm a child of a Holocaust survivor. So it's been quite a long journey it's been a personal journey of discovery, actually finding out about what happened to my father and to his family. And then that, of course, that influenced and shaped me as an individual, my values, the things I cared about, my choices in life. You know, why did I do German at university?
Did you study German?
I did, yes. And
why did you study German?
Well, I didn't realise it at the time, but I think I must have subconsciously known that it was going to inform my research and understanding, because the key question for me in my whole life was, how could a nation which was so cultured actually perpetrate these crimes across the whole of Europe? And so I was sort of seeking this understanding. And so I think my choice in it, my actual choice at university was about trying to access the culture, and through language we can access culture and deeper understanding of, I suppose, the mentality of people who perpetrated this crime. So it's been quite a journey of discovery, you know, through my childhood, right through my university, then through my career choices. So I was always involved in education and training and community development and regeneration, working in inner city communities and challenging prejudice and really championing human rights for all. And I think beneath it all, it was my huge desire that no one else, no other family should actually have to experience the things that my father's family experienced. And I think one thing that people don't realise is that the Shoah didn't finish 70 years ago. It's actually within families today.
Oh, it's the recordings is all carried on?
Well, it's the feeling. It's the it's the memory, and it's the looking for your heritage and trying to understand humanity. You know, how these acts were actually perpetrated. So that, in a way, all of that and the pain of all that stays in families. And that's why people are looking still today for lost relatives, which is why our current project, which has included a collaboration with the International Tracing Service, has been so hugely successful, because we've been able to facilitate families in Yorkshire to actually find out what happened to their relatives. And that's all part of your reconciliation with yourself as a human being.
Now, that's incredible. So is that all part of HSFA? Is that all under that umbrella?
Well, that developed as one of our key projects which we're engaged in at the moment.
And I'm really interested, because you kind of covered it with Yorkshire, but you do only cover Yorkshire. Is it particularly because there's a large portion of survivors living in Yorkshire, or it just because you live here, it's easier for you to create those relationships with local people?
Well, I think we are Yorkshire-based as an organisation. It was established by survivors in Yorkshire. But, of course, the Shoah took place elsewhere. Mm. It didn't take place in Britain. Although, of course, Jersey was occupied, and there's a different story there. But we developed international links with the International Tracing Service, which is based in Germany, and that enabled us to access the Nazi records. And we have a wonderful woman over there called Gabriela Wilke, a German woman who's one of their top researchers, so I have this direct link with Gabriela. So someone will say, can I find out about whoever, you know, my grandmother, my grandfather, my auntie? I get the details and then I email Gabriela, and then she goes through the records, because they have transport lists, they have concentration camp records, they even have sickness records for prisoners who were incarcerated. I mean, the level of detail is just absolutely unbelievable.
Which must be quite heart-wrenching for the families, but just to know what happened to them or to know where they were, it must be quite a nice finish to it. I mean, to draw the line and to kind of say, that's what happened to my family, rather than the unknown.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it draws a line for the survivors. and the families. It doesn't draw a line, but it's something about looking at a piece of paper that's got your family relative on it, and it's sort of like it's proof in a way. It's there.
Real.
And it cannot be denied.
Okay.
It's there. So it gives people a sense of, well, this really happened, didn't it?
The importance of remembering.
Yeah.
And I imagine this is quite resource intensive. Do you have a team of people who work with you? How does it work?
Well, we've got a very committed team of the committee members who are survivors themselves. And we have three staff who actually work for the association. You see, we're quite small and we don't have core government funding. We're basically doing it on the goodwill of people around us. We do have, as I say, we have Tracy Craggs, we have Scott, who do the administration, they do the archiving, the interviewing, etc. And, of course, we've got the support of the Heritage Lottery Fund, which has been really, really helpful in terms of being able to film the survivors, record their testimony. It's enabled us to collect the records from Germany, create the learning resources. And, of course, we've got a team of volunteers. We have about 35 volunteers who are the next generation of Holocaust educators and speakers. So
it's a big team of people who help them.
We've got a great team of people who come from many, many different backgrounds. So they're not all Jewish. Some of them are second and third generation. Some are teachers, but they're all committed to human rights. They're all committed to the remembrance and the commemoration of the Holocaust, but most importantly, about teaching future generations what the lessons are from the Shoah. You know, how did we get from A to B? How did we get from a cultured country to something that was just so horrible?
Gosh, it's fascinating. We're going to take a short break now and listen to one of Lillian's song choices, and we're going to come back afterwards and carry on this conversation because I think we could talk forever about this. It's Somewhere Over the Rainbow by Julie Garland.
Upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you find me, somewhere. Why can't I? happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow. Why, oh, why can't I?
Welcome back to Radio JCOM. I'm Susie Gordon, finding out about the Holocaust Survivors Friendship Association, HSFA, on our newly extended hour programme with my lovely guest, Lillian Black. So, sorry about that break. We just had to break up this programme a little bit. But so we were talking about more about the detail of HSFA, which we will come on to. And during the break, you mentioned today is a very important day for you. Can you tell me why?
Well, I'd like to mention to listeners that today is the 70th anniversary of the deportation of the Hungarian Jews, and we have a number of families in the Leeds area, including my own, who had family members who were murdered through the Hungarian Holocaust. So today marks the 70th anniversary of their deportation. So we're thinking about all those families in Leeds today who are no doubt thinking about this day.
Isn't that amazing that it's not publicised, really? Like, it's kind of... I wasn't aware of it. So, that people... There isn't so much talk about the Hungarian Holocaust.
Well, it came late, did the Hungarian Holocaust. But when it came, it was fast and it was furious. And it's incredible to think that 8,000 people were rounded up and deported in between 6 to 8 weeks and sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau. So that's, if you think about the city of Leeds with 750,000 people approximately, and just think about that number of 438,000, it's just incredible.
It's hard
really.
To pit. I mean, it's really hard to get your head around it.
Yeah. And, of course, there's commemoration happening in Hungary, which, of course, has been quite controversial, I have to say. It's always been very difficult in Hungary. They had big challenges facing their past because, of course, it was the Hungarian police who were complicit in rounding up the Jews. There weren't so many Nazis in Hungary. But they led the rounding up of the Jews, but it was the Hungarian police who were actually most complicit in that. So it's taken a long time for Hungary to face its past. And, of course, there's masses of anti-Semitic activity underway and anti-Roma activity
as
well.
It's so sad,
isn't it? Very sad.
It's still happening.
Terrible. But of course,
and in France as well, I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah,
we're not learning.
And that's why the HSFA and organisations like us have got to go out there and actually educate people so that we can actually begin to understand how a genocide is perpetrated. You know, that it starts with the erosion of human values, that we look at others who are different and we think they're less worthy of life. We could see that in the health service. We could see it in government, and this is why it's important that we vote, we choose the politicians that we want to represent our views. And I've got great faith in Britain that we are committed to human rights. We've got some of the best equality legislation in the world, and I know this from my international work, and I think we're very fortunate in Britain, and long may it continue. It's important that people get out there and vote and make choices to make sure that the far right don't actually have any place in representing what we're about as Britain.
Extremist political views are the scariest, aren't they, really?
Oh, absolutely.
Extreme.
Absolutely.
And they can wash it down to make it sound like they're going for...
Yeah.
Something personal, and it's going to help you and it's going to help the country, and it doesn't sound like it's an extremist view because they hide it quite well.
They do very well.
Clever,
very well,
which is why they're doing so well at the moment.
Yeah, but not in Britain.
That's really interesting. And that must be partly to do with the work that you do as well, of education and getting people from school age to really understand what happened in the Second World War, the First World War, the Second World War, and educating from a very, very young age of what can happen.
That's right, and I think that's why the different stories that we've captured, which show the different aspects of the Holocaust, you know, we have survivors who talk about the 1930s, about what happened at Kristallnacht. We have a hidden child who talks about escaping from Paris, being passed to different families in France. You know, how the next door neighbour, when the family was being arrested, she actually rushed into their apartment, grabbed this girl by the hand and said, "You naughty girl, why are you in here?" Dragged her out, and that actually saved her from being deported. And that's, she was then passed down the line. So it's, the Shoah is a story of absolute horror, but it's a story also of ordinary men and women who stood up and were counted and were very brave and rescued individuals. Of course, there weren't enough of them because we know what the outcome of the Holocaust was. So we collect these stories, you know, showing different aspects. People who were in Auschwitz, we have captured their experience.
How do you capture them? How do you get people to really open up to you? Because it must be, if they don't know you as well, I mean, it must be very hard for them to relive their story.
I think this has been the beauty of the association, that first of all, we became friends. And then we brought professional resources in. So Tracy Craggs is very, very experienced, very skilled, and her background is in oral testimony. So we've got the relationship first. We don't send an individual, unknown individual, into somebody's home and film them and talk to them about their experience. And we do it in a very sensitive way, and we do it with people who feel ready to actually talk about it, and we support them through that process. So we don't just go in and interview them and then away we go. We are friends with these people.
You have the relationship.
We do.
And what kind of projects are you involved in that have taken, the ones that maybe a few years ago had started, that the HSFA are really proud of, things that have happened that you're very proud of?
Well, we started really with a project which was called The Journeys. And this was really capturing some of the stories and then producing visual maps of where people originated from and what their journey was. So that was the creation of the digital testimony. And then the maps were, as I say, showing where people came from. So we could use that. We created these learning resources, which were less sophisticated than we have now. So that was the beginning of the work. And then we realised that we needed to educate the educators. So the next project was about actually working with schools, with teachers, and actually creating materials, because they were telling us that they wanted to teach the Holocaust, but they didn't have the background, they didn't have the knowledge. And how could we support them in developing their own, I suppose it's their own personal development, really. So that was the next project, which was the creation of some training materials.
So are you involved in the curriculum for the Holocaust?
Yes.
Gosh.
Yes. And,
okay.
and then, of course, the Holocaust can be used in so many different ways. It can be used in the arts, through drama. We had children creating poetry, depicting the feeling and the images of the Holocaust. And that's another role that we've developed over time as well, which is really, we sit on the planning committees across the local authorities in Yorkshire, advising really on the Holocaust Remembrance, the Holocaust Memorial Day, which takes place in January every year.
You're quite influential, so, really. I mean, you have contacts in high places, obviously, and you have a voice. I mean, you're given a voice here, which is quite amazing to for people to not, especially in education, to think they know everything, they can do everything. Like, you have quite a powerful tool available to you to pass on to the schools.
Well, it's quite sad, really, Susie, because I think, really, if you know, if I was going on Mastermind, it would be the Holocaust. And I think, such a sad creature. But I suppose over years, and I'm not saying how old I am.
Very young.
Well, I've gained this knowledge, you see, by going back with my father to the camps that he was in. And to, you know, we had a family visit to Auschwitz. That was my first visit there. We never managed to persuade him that he would go back to where he was born. That was one thing he felt he could never face. But through these life experiences, and it was the best thing ever for my father to go back to Germany and to visit the camps he was in, because actually he saw a new Germany and he met new Germans. They were different. And we always said that it was two sides of the same coin, that I, as the daughter of a survivor, was trying to understand the perpetrators, and they, as children of the perpetrators, or the bystanders, were equally trying to grasp how their forefathers had actually perpetrated these crimes. So somehow the bringing together of that and seeing the new Germany, It removed hatred. It removed hatred because there was a lot of hatred, anti-German feeling.
I can understand
in
that,
my
I
own
think.
Family.
And worry and being scared as well. I imagine hearing a German accent even. I mean,
oh yeah,
I find it hard. And I went to university with a lot of Germans,
yeah.
And I do remember having that. I never met a German before, hearing
yeah.
that very strong accent.
Yeah.
You just related to the films that you saw. And my family aren't so much Holocaust survivors. I had a couple who fought in the war, but
yeah.
I haven't got that heritage. But yeah, it's still there. I had to actually discuss it with them because
yeah.
I didn't want to feel nervous and I didn't want to get goosebumps every time I heard them speaking. And we did have a very open discussion about it.
Yeah.
For that reason.
I mean, I think our most sort of, our deepest experience was actually going back to the camps and meeting young Germans. And all I can say, I'll never forget my father saying to these young Germans, because they were crying, because they were meeting my father, and he said, "But it wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. And what you have to do is make sure this never happens again." Well, there's nothing more powerful, is there?
And that is a perfect time now to take another short break, and we'll come back and carry on this conversation, because that's really interesting. That's, I think, a good starting point for when we return. We're going to listen to a very meaningful song, and we'll come back to why we're playing it after this break. It's My Yiddisha Mama by Sophie Tucker.
Of things I should be thankful for, I've had a goodly share. And as I sit here in the comfort of a cozy chair, my fancy takes me to a humble east side tenement. Three flights in the rear to where my childhood days were spent. It wasn't much like paradise, but amid the dirt and all, there sat the sweetest danger, one that I fondly call my Yiddish.
the never now. My Yiddish mama, I'd love to kiss that wrinkled brow. I long to hold her hands once more, as in days gone by, and ask her to forgive me for things I did that made her cry. How few were her pleasures. She never cared for fashion style. Her jewels and treasures, she found them in her baby smile. Oh, I know that I owe what I am today to that dear little lady, so old and gray, to that wonderful Yiddish mama.
Welcome back to Radio JCOM. I'm Susie Gordon, finding out about the Holocaust Friendship, Holocaust Survivors Friendship Association, HSFA, still with Lillian Black. So the last thing you... we're going to talk about this song that we just heard. My Yiddish...
Yiddish Mama.
why did you choose this song?
Well, I chose My Yiddish Mama because I grew up with that song. And also, that was the very first song that my father heard after his liberation from Bergen-Belsen. And, of course, he'd lost his family at Auschwitz. And so it's a song that's just always been in the family, and I really love it. And I sing it as well. So
they've played it since you were growing up, and you heard this song. And
yes.
You can picture it on the big gramophone.
Yes.
And how lovely.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so you said at the very end of the last section, we talk about it so we never forget. And I'm assuming that is the main aim of the whole of HSFA, is to be able to talk about the horrendousness that happened so that we are continuously educating so people never forget what happened so it doesn't get repeated. Am I right?
Well, you are. And it was, I think, probably about 3 years ago that we began to think about the sustainability of the legacy, because we had this wonderful programme of survivors going out into schools, talking at Holocaust memorial events. And it was a thought I didn't really like to think about, which was, what will we do when we haven't got the living testimony with us? What are we going to do about this? And so we developed a concept of, right, first of all, we need to make sure we've captured all the testimonies. So that was the first point. We must record it, we must digitise it, we must make it available for the future when survivors are not there. And through technology, you can actually talk to a group of people and you can use these video clips. So that was the first thing we thought about. And then the second thing was, well, we'd been to Bad Arolsen in Germany and we'd seen the extent of the records. And so I was thinking, well, if we've got the evidence, I mean, obviously we believe the survivors, but if there are records that can actually support that journey, that experience that they had, and I discovered that they had 60 million records, I thought, well, let's link the records to the survivor testimony. So that's how we established the relationship with the International Tracing Service. And we got some absolutely amazing records coming through. I mean, it was unbelievable. You know, that, for example, I'll talk about my own father, mm-hmm. right? For example, his journey was from Munkacs in what was then Hungary to Auschwitz-Birkenau. So there was his record card, there was a thing called a maintenance card, and then when he was sent to Buchenwald, there was a transport list with all the people in the wagons. Then there was another registration card from Buchenwald. He went to Dora Mittelbau, which was the underground rocket factory where he was a slave labourer. He thought he was there for 3 months, but the record showed he was there for 5 months. So how he survived that, I mean, children ask him this, and he can't answer it. But there's a record there, and there were 2 sickness records of when he got flu.
They kept everything.
Yeah. And then another record when he was transferred to a subcamp called Hartzungen. And then eventually, as the Allies advanced, he was sent on a journey all over Germany for 7 days and 7 nights. And they were offloaded at a ramp, and then they marched into Bergen-Belsen, about 8 kilometres. And there were about 3,000 set off, and there were only about 400 actually marched through the gates. But they had a record, that there was a list. And then when he was liberated, we only discovered this 6 years ago, he actually had a certificate to go to Palestine, and he never knew about it.
My gosh.
But this is all recorded, and then there was a photograph of him. It was like a great thick wad of documents which were created by the bureaucracy of the Holocaust. So what we were sure about was that we could link these records to the digital testimony, and then we could train the next generation of speakers. And that was the key, in a way, that we thought we had to somehow be able to transfer the legacy in the records into a new generation of speakers. So what we did then was we actually created a training programme about the Holocaust, which actually was quite difficult because, of course, there's lots of material out there. But how do you produce something that's accurate, that's evidence-based, but can be captured so that it's in, if you like, bite-sized program. It's digestible.
Mm-hmm.
So we created this training program. We had the digital testimony. We had PowerPoint presentations created, which had the photographs of survivor speakers' families that could communicate the story in different settings in schools. Because, of course, some schools are great with the technology, and others, you know, they still need the PowerPoint. So we created that, and then we recruited 35 volunteers who had to go through an interview process. You know, they had to be selected, and then we put them on a training programme, which also included a visit to Auschwitz-Birkenau. So we created the next generation of speakers, and we felt that was how we could actually carry the legacy forward. So that's basically what we're doing now. But, of course, the problem is, Susie, that the more we're doing it, the more people want to become engaged, and we are only a small organisation and we don't have core resources. But that's never sort of got in our way. You know, we've got a vision and a mission, and we're going to carry on, and we feel we owe it to the memory of our families and for the future of Britain and the world, really, that we need to carry on with this work. It's just so important.
It's amazing how it started as just a little, kind of, I suppose, like a coffee morning, like a little social gathering, to what it has now become.
That's right.
And obviously that actually probably down to you more than anyone, of developing this actually into something worthwhile and meaningful that can ensure people are educated, and not just educated well, properly, with, you know, you talk about facts.
Yeah.
It's not just about hearsay. It you back it up with factual evidence.
We do. We think that's important for going forward. Because what will we do when we don't have survivors there for them to say, well, actually, I was there. I did stand in the line. I was at Auschwitz. You know, how will we combat Holocaust deniers in the future? So we think this is quite, well, this is unique in how we've brought those three key elements together. And we've also made it accessible on our website. And this is also quite an incredible, well, I think it's an incredible story, that we have created this website with all the materials on it, giving people also an opportunity to write articles of commemoration. So if an individual wants to write about a particular thing that's happening to them and a particular commemoration, we have a section that is about commemoration. We have people who write poems, as I said earlier. We can put them online. But the most incredible thing is, for it's only a small organisation. It's a good website, but we have, at the last count, in the last 4 weeks, we had over 7,000 visitors to the website from 126 countries.
That's amazing.
It's just totally unbelievable. So I think to myself, well, if I had more resources, just think what we could do. But I don't worry about that, because I think if you've got the passion and you've got the vision, then you just get on with it, don't you? And let's not worry about money.
Well, in terms of money, I mean, obviously you need the money for this to happen. Yeah. How do you support this organisation financially? Where do you get your money from?
Well, we've been really, really fortunate. The Heritage Lottery Fund people in Leeds have been absolutely fantastic. I mean, I think they've seen the vision. They've met the survivors. They love the survivors. I mean, you said earlier that you know, it's been down to me. Well, it's not really been down to me at all. It's been down to the survivors. And I think that's the difference with our organisation. It's survivor-driven. And if you've met our survivors, and I know you have, you'll know what I mean about me being driven by them. And I have a lovely little story. I remember saying to one of our oldest survivors, Mrs. Neil, who's 90, "Oh, Ibby, I've got an awful lot on my plate at the moment." And she said, "My dear," she said, "get a bigger plate." And I've never forgotten that. And that's the great thing about our survivors and why I love doing this work, because I love them, because I think they're an inspiration. But the things they've been through and how they came to Britain through all sorts of different routes, and they made a new life.
But even their time
amazing.
In Britain, I mean, that was tough in itself. It wasn't just
very difficult.
They went to Britain and then their life was set up. I mean,
no.
In Leeds particularly, I know this from my role, is just learning about the history of the Jews in Leeds and the Leylands. Life was not easy. Jobs weren't easy to find.
Not
people still anti-Semitic, didn't want to employ Jewish people. I mean, they had a very tough life.
Yeah, I think there are many different stories. There are some really great stories and there are some pretty awful stories. But I think the thing that I cling on to is it's the kindness of strangers, that I know so many people who helped. Individual acts, and our survivors overcame all obstacles. And I think that's why they're still alive at the moment, because they are true survivors. And I just find them a complete inspiration. So whenever I'm feeling a bit down or a bit, you know, I think about them and I think, well, you know, look what they went through. You know, who am I to
complain?
To complain. So
it's very humbling, isn't it?
It is humbling, and it's difficult, isn't it? Because we've all got our own personal experiences. We've all got our own challenges. But I just look at them and I just think, well, they're just amazing.
And we're very lucky not to have gone through it ourselves.
We're very fortunate because, you know, if he'd occupied Britain, well, none of us would have been here, really.
And I want to bring on now the Holocaust Commission, because I know this is something that's actually been quite frustrating for you. We've had quite a lot of discussion about it in London. You've been invited to go down to 10 Downing Street. Can you just explain a bit more about this?
Well, the Holocaust Commission has been established by the Prime Minister, by David Cameron. who wants to create a lasting memory for the Holocaust. And obviously they've become aware that we're at a critical point in time as survivors become older, more frail, etc. So we're faced with the reality that they're not going to be with us forever. So we were very concerned as the HSFA to actually contribute to the consultations which were being organised to basically share what we've been doing and the challenges of commemoration and thinking about the way forward, because we really felt we'd started this process about 3 years ago. So that's really what the meeting in London will be about. I did go to the survivor consultation with two of our local survivors down to Wembley Stadium. I was disappointed that there wasn't a consultation held by Number 10 in Leeds. There was actually one held in Manchester, and there was one held in Newark, which we didn't actually know about. I mean, I suppose we're quite a small organisation, to be fair, and we don't put a lot of emphasis on, if you like, promoting, marketing. You know, we're busily getting on with doing the job.
Yes.
So I was a bit disappointed, and it was quite, you know, quite a challenge really to go there and back to London in a day. But we were determined.
I mean, they'd invited all the survivors to come down.
That's right.
Day, which
yeah.
for 90-year-old people, I mean, that was your biggest.
Well, I was disappointed really at well I thought was a lack of sensitivity really that yes come to London but there was no support really. But there's no point moaning about things in life. I think you just got to work with the grain and
you say
and get
that. So you kind of, from what you said when you went down to London, you did moan a little bit to somebody who was quite influential, Mick Davis, who then had actually then reported it back to the Cabinet to say, hang on, I've listened to Lillian.
Well, I didn't actually realise that it was Mick Davis sitting on the table, which I should have done my research. My husband told me off about that, but I'm sure. No,
it's probably in your favour because you're actually more natural with it.
Well, what I did was I basically, at the consultation, along with two of our survivors, we talked about what we were doing in Leeds. And I might have had a little whinge in somebody's ear about the lack of sensitivity. You know, how could they expect? I mean, they were actually going to send a bus for our survivors, which I said was ridiculous, to go on a bus there and back to Wembley. You know, I mean, it just complete in one day. But you've got to get on with these things. But anyway, he must have heard what I said, because the next thing was there was an email from the chap who's heading up the commission, and as a result of that I will be going down to London to just make sure that the survivor views from Leeds and the wider community are input to the what I think is probably quite a big mixing bowl at the moment, because how do you commemorate the Holocaust in Britain? I mean, if you go to Berlin, or if you go to Auschwitz-Birkenau, or if you go to the sites of the genocide, there's a way to contextualise the Holocaust. Of course, in Britain, we were fortunately not occupied. So it's going to be a big question how...
There's no central point.
Not really. And, of course, the other thing is we've got lots of examples of commemoration across the whole of Britain. I mean, I'm aware of all sorts of wonderful individual and organisational commemorations. I mean, I don't know how many people know that there is a statue of a British soldier who was part of the Liberation Force of Bergen-Belsen sitting overlooking the beach at Scarborough. I mean, how many people know about that? Just think about, you know, the Marjorie and Arnold Ziff Centre. Think about that wonderful book that's been created.
The 150th anniversary of Leeds.
Yeah. And the one that is the commemoration book where survivor families could record the names of their family members who perished. You know, so we've got lots of examples. We go to the synagogue in Bradford. The chairman is Rudy Lever. And if you look on the wall, they have commemoration plaques up there. So lots of individual ways of remembering. But so I don't know exactly what the commission is looking for. I don't know if they're looking for a big monument that would be in London, or they're looking at something different. But I have some ideas that I'd like to share. And, of course, it's about the important role of education. And I'd really like to see an education centre in Yorkshire, because, you know, if they create a single education centre in London, it's not really very accessible for people in the north. And, you know, that was, of course, because it was a consultation in London, then in the main it was London survivors who, of course, were, you know, very, really want to have a commemoration that would be located in London. But I think we do need something that covers the whole of Britain somehow.
And with the, I assume, the large amount of impact, if you're going to spend money on something rather than just a monument of some kind, saying an education centre, it's a resource, yeah, it's actually very useful.
Absolutely.
Rather than relying on people to contextualise a statue,
yeah,
without any understanding,
yeah,
of what it's there for, unless their parents tell them or they're with people who know.
That's right.
But having an actual resource. So you've now got Andrew Morris, who you're meeting.
That's
hopefully
right.
You'll have his ear now to be able to explain your story, which is amazing to have that link that you've got with London. And actually, hopefully, and then we wish you luck as well, that
thank
we actually get
much,
our
Susie.
Voice heard.
Yeah, thank you, Susie.
Then on to, if people want to help, obviously you're seeking volunteers all the time, you need more resources, you need more funding. I mean, this could grow. How do people get in touch with you? How do they find out about the Holocaust Survivors Association?
People would like to go online. Most people can go online now, or they've got children or grandchildren who can help them. If they look at our website, it's holocaustlearning.org, and you'll be able to see what we're doing there. If people did want to donate, there is Virgin Just Giving, so you can donate online. And there is also an email address, which is enquiries@holocaustlearning.org. So if people want to help in any shape or form, send us an email, and we'd be delighted to hear from people. And we're going to carry on this work. We're not giving up. And I'm very confident that with the relationships we have with the University of Leeds, with the University of Huddersfield, and also I'd like to mention the University of Hull. We've done some wonderful work with Hull. So there are some great people out there who want to make that contribution, and we're delighted to work with them, and we want to do the best we can for the memory of the Holocaust victims, and we will.
Your dad must be so proud of you. He must be so chuffed that you're kind of taking this from him, of actually making it into something really worthwhile.
Well, it's quite funny, really, but when I became the chair of the HSFA, it's a funny story, really. But I was always too busy, you see. I became a member, and my father was a member. And there was a discussion about, they were looking for a chair, and I always said, well, I was far too busy. But eventually I was persuaded that I ought to do this, that I had the, if you like, the CV for it. And then afterwards, when I was appointed, then my father and my husband had a good joke about this, because they asked each other, who would she blame? Would it be my father, or would it be my husband who get the blame for this? So there's a family joke in all that. But I'm delighted to do it, and I, all credit to the survivors who created this, really. And all I did was maybe bring some experience and expertise. You know, from my role as a corporate director, I sort of applied all that and my own personal history for the better of, I suppose, humanity. Sounds a bit grand, really, but I just care. You know, I think that we have to treat people as we would wish to be treated ourselves, and there is too much out there that's not very nice. But equally, there are some very good people out there also, and, you know, we have to work together, don't we, for a better future.
Oh, thank you so much, Lillian. Have you got anything? We're about to finish this programme. Is there anything that you'd like to say to the listeners just before we close this programme? Is there anything you'd like to add?
Health and happiness to all the listeners. That's what I wish for. And if anybody feels a bit down, because we've been talking about the Holocaust, you know, just, I suppose what I want to say is that the acts and the kindnesses of strangers to our family are just, you know, you can't count them. There've been so many as my father made his journey to Britain, and just amazing people. And I just think we're so fortunate. We've got lots of positive things going on in Britain, and we just need to appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Lillian. I could speak to you for so long about this subject. Maybe we'll get you back again. We wish you every success. We hope that HSFA grows and develops, and I'm sure with you backing it up, it will be, and if you get funding, it will be a massive strength in our community. And thank you also really to the survivors for sharing such an emotional and probably an incredibly, incredibly difficult story for them. But without those stories, we don't really have very much. So a real big thank you to them as well. It's All About You is produced by Noel Summery, presented by me, Susie Gordon. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day.
This is your Leeds Jewish station, Radio JCOM.